All right, everybody, welcome to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Philip Drew, Administrator, and our first guest today is Jeff Neal. He is the national chair of the Libertarian Party. Would you like to give the audience a basic description of what the Libertarian Party is about, for starters?
Sure. Obviously, we're a political party. We've been around since 1971. Libertarian Party is dedicated to some pretty simple principles. We believe the role of the government should be as minimal as possible, but its primary functions are defending the rights of individuals. And pretty much beyond that, it ought to just get out of our way. So as a political party, of course, we are dedicated to working within the system as much as possible in order to change the system. We run candidates. We'll probably have somewhere in the range of 1,500 to 2,000 candidates nationwide this year. We've in the 2000 election, the last one of any real consequence, the Libertarian Party received 50% more votes than the Green Party did in all of its races nationwide. In fact, here in Texas, which is where I live, our candidates received over 3 million votes. We had one guy finishing with 857,000 votes in a judicial position race. So there's a lot of people out there who do vote for us, and we're seeking to make that an even bigger number.
That's interesting that you say that the Libertarian Party has so many more voters than the Green Party does, and yet they get all the television as compared to the Libertarian Party. Why do you think that is?
Well, first off, the number one thing is the Green Party was getting almost no press whatsoever until Ralph Nader came along and lent his name to their cause. And I think just the same way the Reform Party, with Jesse Ventura and Ross Perot, received press. When they disappeared, everything went off the radar. In fact, the only news that the Reform Party has made since Jesse Ventura's win, of course, was Pat Buchanan seeking their nomination. So in politics, I'm afraid there's, to a certain degree, there's a link between name recognition and the willingness of the media to give mention. And I don't think it's any surprise. Anybody who's into music knows they'll cover Michael Jackson, and they'll cover Britney Spears, but up-and-coming bands they don't want to take a gamble with. Same thing with independent movies. You name it. The media is a creature of the public perception. As the public demands more, they'll play more. We'll get more press as the people get more and more tired of the Republicans and the Democrats.
Now, the Libertarian Party National Convention is coming up at the end of this month. And unlike the Republicans and Democrats, the Libertarian Party actually chooses its presidential nominee at their convention, right?
Yeah, we do. It's politics the way it was meant to be, you know. Smoke-filled rooms and people wrangling and debating and arguing. It's not a foregone conclusion like it is with the Democrats and the Republicans. I mean, I think it's amusing that most people in this country aren't aware that there was more than one candidate for president. The presidential nomination on the Republican ballot. There were dozens of people who put their name in, but of course they got zero press as well. On the Democratic side, there were three candidates, I believe, Kucinich, Sharpton, and Carl Moseley Braun, all of who raised less money than one of the candidates for the Democratic nomination. And of course that's our... Oh, God, no. It's just lost my mind. It's the crazy guy, the near communist guy, Lyndon LaRouche.
Oh, I thought you were going to say John Kerry.
No. Well, you know, that might apply to him too as well, I'm sure. But Lyndon LaRouche did better than raise much more money than many of the presidential nominees for the Democratic Party. But he was not invited to debates. The media didn't want to cover him, and so his candidacy, although fairly well supported, went nowhere. So the media certainly picks its darlings in order to cover. And we have failed to this point in putting forward a candidate that grasps public interest enough. And I think that will come.
Well, and the better candidates you get, the better you'll get next time, and the better you'll get the time after that.
Well, I'm afraid one of the problems is that in politics it doesn't necessarily mean the best candidate is the one that's going to get the press. I mean, a good example is about 1,600 people ran for governor in California? No, that wasn't that many, but there was, 160, 180. and there was literally only about five that got any mention whatsoever. And, of course, all the press paid attention to was Arnold Schwarzenegger. Now, I've got a lot of respect for what he's done, turning bodybuilding and B-movies into a pretty decent-sized empire. The guy's got money. I mean, obviously, you don't do that without either skills of your own or the ability to pick good people to manage things for you, both of which are good characteristics. But having no experience in ruling, it obviously, if he's successful, if people view that his role as governor is a successful role, it should be obvious to people that it obviously is not a rare skill to be able to govern. Perhaps the rare skill is to be elected and be able to govern, because we sure seem to end up with a lot of people who end up in government who don't seem as qualified as a lot of the people out in other industries. But that notoriety has nothing to do with his political background. It has to do with the Terminator. And so him being a viable candidate, name recognition is more important than anything else in the political world. It's a sad statement, really. It says America would rather remember who their candidate is, even if they don't remember what he stands for.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of name recognition, who are the front runners for the nomination for president in the Libertarian Party?
Well, you know, I could get into trouble for giving this information out. I'm expected
to
say...
Yeah, don't say who the front runners are, then. Just say who the candidates are.
Well, how about I put it this way? There are three candidates that have been prominent in their campaigns, traveling around the states, you know, visiting our conventions. One is a local boy from Austin, Texas, which is where it's local to me, named Michael Bednarik. The second is Gary Nolan, who's a radio talk show host out of Cincinnati, but I now believe he's living in Virginia. And the third is Aaron Russo, who's a Hollywood producer out of Los Angeles. And these are the three guys who've been really, you know, making the circuit and talking to as many people as they can and really running very visible campaigns. And promises to be a pretty, pretty tight race.
They seem pretty close in their numbers up until this point.
The funny thing about the Libertarian Party is because we don't have any bound delegations, because our delegates are free to choose when they get there who they're going to vote for, the entire race can swing on a single debate or a single incident or, you know, you really get to get political tactics into it when you can come and make a real great presentation to the delegates and come in with that last minute pitch of why you're the right guy. It's going to be a tough race, and there's, you know, and a lot of it is for very simple reasons. Aaron Russo is more of the guy who's got the he's got more visibility outside of the Libertarian Party and claims to have connections in the Hollywood community. I don't have any reason to dispute him. He's a Hollywood producer that's, he used to manage Manhattan Transfer and Bette Midler. He produced the movie Trading Places and The Rose, and he's done a lot of other things as well, and claims to know a lot of people. I don't dispute it. I mean, if you're in that business, I'm sure you do get to meet a lot of the movers and shakers in the media business. Today, politics is all about media. Gary Nolan is somebody who's been a very long proponent of libertarian ideas, and he's very good at speaking with people. He's great on the radio. He's got a lot of radio presence. He's done that. His notoriety is more from being a radio talk show host, not the shock jock type. You know, he's more of I don't know if you call them upper caliber, but he doesn't do embarrassing things. Very intelligent guy. And Michael Bednarik is a constitutional scholar, somebody who probably understands the Constitution better than about, I'd say, 99% of Congress, understands the role that the Constitution does play, what the government's role is supposed to be, and his goal has been to get out there and teach people that we've been lied to about what the Constitution really means, that we have rights that we're not even aware of. Three totally different perspectives these guys come from. three totally different styles, and that makes it difficult. If you're just dealing with two people that are right on the same page on every single thing, well, maybe go with the guy who dresses better. But this one is certainly a matter of totally different perspectives. It's going to be an interesting race.
Well, and if Michael Bednar gets the nomination, he might not be on the ballot in his own home state of Texas. Isn't that right?
Well, I mean, if we don't gain ballot access here, that would be true. But it would, given that, it wouldn't matter who it was. If we don't get ballot access here in Texas, we're going to be in a severe disadvantage.
And why don't you have access to the ballot? Weren't you on the ballot last time?
We were last time. Texas rules are pretty interesting. If you can win a race and the threshold, in order to stay on the ballot, you need to get 5% in a statewide race. And since 1986, we've done that. In 2002, the landscape changed significantly. The Green Party decided to run somebody in almost every race, and the Democrats decided to as well. I guess it was pretty much of a last-ditch effort to make sure the Republicans didn't take over every single statewide race, but unfortunately it failed. The Republicans did retain just about all, I think they did retain every single one, didn't they?
Yeah.
The statewide races.
It's pretty much a one-party state again. It just switched which party it is.
Well, and the other thing is that historically, there have always been a lot of races that are not hotly contested. I mean, and a good example is that we're only running two judicial candidates this time, and neither of them have opposition from the Greens or the Democrats. It's only a Republican. Now, in those situations, we're guaranteed to get 5% because there's always people who vote against the Republicans, no matter who it is. So we have, and in 2000, in one of those races, we got almost 19% running against, our candidate running against Al Gonzalez. In the last election, we had nothing but four-way races we were running in. And we still managed to get close to 4.2 in one of the four races, but it's not enough.
Well, and it was a midterm election, which generates a lot less interest from the people.
Oh, there's no doubt. There's no doubt of that. I mean, it generates a lot less traffic at the polls. You tend to get the party stalwarts going more. The number of swing votes does reduce in an off-year election. There's no doubt about that. But even so, if we'd had a full slate of judicial candidates, we would have gotten ballot access because there were three-way races that we would have gotten. The number that the Greens pulled in tied with the Libertarians would have been enough to stick us over the top, but we didn't. And that's politics. That's the way it goes. So now we have to get 45,000 ballot signatures, and I believe we've got about another 2 weeks to do it. I believe we're north of 50,000 right now, but there's a fairly high error rate in petitioning in Texas, and one of the reasons is we're now the only state in the country with what's called a primary screen-out rule, where you cannot sign a party petition to get them on the general ballot if you participated in a primary.
And you can't start getting petitions until after the primaries are over, right?
That's right. It's a 75-day window, which in most electioneering terms is very short.
Wait, hang on one second, Jeff. Let's put this in absolute perspective for people far away who need to, you know, understand exactly what we're talking about here. In the state of Texas, you have how long to get your signatures?
You have 75 days to collect.
And you have to get how many?
We have to get 1% of the number of votes cast in the last gubernatorial election. So there were 4.5 million, so we have to get 45,000. Now, that doesn't sound to be too...
You can't get anybody who voted in the primaries, and you can't start until after the primaries are over.
That's right. You automatically exclude the people who voted in the primary. And in a presidential year, the number of people who participate in the primary is pretty high. So, you know, if you've got a 50% turnout for the primary vote, that means that we have to get our numbers from the 50% who didn't participate. Now, the other thing, of course, is somebody might say, well, that doesn't sound too tough. That's 1 in 50. But first off, those 50% that didn't vote are the ones least inclined to participate in the process at all. I think that makes sense to you, doesn't it?
Sure.
Additionally, you do run into people who will say, no, I don't want to do that because I don't want to, I don't want any vote to be cast against my guy. So, you know, you have to go out and ask people, of course. If you tie that in with the fact that we have to find places where we can petition, 20 years ago, shopping centers said, sure, no problem, we're in favor of the political process. Today, it's very difficult to do any petitioning on private property because of liability cases. They don't want to touch it. So you're reduced to picking places where you can petition. We're not allowed to petition at places like University of Texas unless we're a student group, which, of course, you know, that makes it a little difficult. You're really reduced to very few places that you can petition. The number of people you can hit is low. If you could hit HEBs or, you know, supermarkets of some kind or going down to the, you know, in front of the shopping center, you could hit a lot of people, but we're not able to do that. We literally almost have to walk along the street and stop people. In today's car culture, that means the number of people you're going to find is relatively low. Of course, you can go door to door and hope there are people are home. You can imagine the yield on that. And if you tie the whole thing in also with the fact that we have to read a 73-word statement to them, to the person who's signing, that basically recounts the law but also says some things that are patently untrue. It tells them that they cannot participate in the primary. Well, of course they can't. The primary's already over. But it gets a lot of people the idea they cannot participate in the next one. So it's difficult.
Well,
tie that all together.
Like the Democrats and the Republicans have done a really good job of making it almost impossible for anybody to run against them in this state.
Yep, that's right. But, you know, on the other standpoint, we haven't yet challenged it in court. And I believe we have a very strong case to challenge it in court.
Sounds like it to me.
Well, yeah, and it's an interesting one because there was one of the first ballot access cases ever in the U.S. was back in 1967. It was a case of, I can't remember what the name of the party was. It was a relatively obscure party, sued Georgia because their ballot access requirements stated you had to get 5% of registered voters to sign a petition. And they said that that was a violation of the 14th Amendment and the First Amendment.
That's funny, libertarians invoking the 14th Amendment.
Yeah, but the thing is, the courts upheld it, but the reason they upheld it was interesting. And they said they upheld it because the rules apply to all, so the Equal Protection Clause didn't come into it. And as far as freedom of speech, it wasn't limiting freedom of speech. What it was doing was, since anybody who wanted to could sign the petition, and you could sign any number of petitions for any number of parties, they ruled it constitutional, which for me is, you know, you got to read between the lines when you file a suit with federal courts. Texas does not allow any registered voter to sign this petition, and they do not allow people to sign for more than one. So in other words, if you say as an intelligent voter, you know, I want to protect my right to vote for whoever I choose, whichever party I choose in the general election, why shouldn't you be able to say, I want the Greens on the ballot and I want the Libertarians on the ballot? Why should you be restricted to one? And I believe that is unconstitutional. If for some reason we're rejected on this petition, we will be filing suit. I can guarantee you that. And it would be in federal court, most likely. The Supreme Court a long time ago said that ballot access, it was constitutional to impose what they called a reasonable modicum of support. Had to be verified before putting someone on the ballot. Well, we can easily show a reasonable modicum of support. The problem is that we can't get people to sign it because of the restrictions.
Right. Well, and not only that, but libertarians are, by definition, individualists and aren't really too into joining groups and signing petitions in the first place.
Yeah, especially when you're getting your name and address and all that kind of stuff. It's like,
half of libertarians think that you shouldn't vote at all because all you're doing is helping encourage them.
Well, that's true. You know, to a certain degree, I suppose you are. However, my viewpoint on it is that you should do whatever you can to use the tools of the enemy to defeat him. I've seen enough instances in this country of unlikely candidates winning unlikely victories, like Jesse Ventura, for example, to know that it's possible. And the question is, can we, first, can we win? But second, if we win, can we change things? I'd be ready to give up if after winning and putting people in Congress, they all ended up being corrupted by the system, then I'd be willing to admit that there was no hope. But at this point, that's not something I'm willing to admit, because I know certainly if I got elected to Congress, I wouldn't be taking bribes. And, you know, I'd be the guy that, I'd be the guy on lots of people's hit lists, probably.
You know, during, especially an election year like this, a presidential election year, where all the focus is on Bush versus Kerry, and I know that you'll feel where I'm going with this, when, from especially a libertarian perspective, there's not the single slightest bit of difference. They're nothing but two wings on the same bird of prey. And it seems to me like there's so much focus on the presidential election, where, let's face it, if Bednarik, Russo, or Gary Nolan get the nomination and run for president, they're at best going to do, you know, probably less than 10%, maybe. And it seems like such resources spent on a presidential election where we really have no choice, where our presidential candidates are chosen for us in advance by those who already have all the power. Shouldn't it be the role of the Libertarian Party to really focus on the House of Representatives? Because, after all, and I know, you know, being the chairman of the Libertarian Party, you know the Constitution. And the Constitution really gives all the power to the House of Representatives. And the President and the Senate and the Supreme Court basically can't do a gosh darn thing unless the House of Representatives is willing to go along. So, why doesn't the Libertarian Party really focus on the House, where the Constitution puts all the power?
Well, the funny thing is, you know, I think that if you're going to take a long-term effect, you really need to look at and analyze the effects of what's called the coattail effect. Now, of course, everybody knows about it in politics. If you get a landslide for a Republican, it tends to pull up the vote count for downstream Republicans. Victories of the Libertarian Party would more likely be regional. If tomorrow we could put five people into Congress, they'd sit on no committees. You know, they'd make no decision. They wouldn't get enough sponsors for their bills to get them heard. They wouldn't get through calendars. They'd just basically be ignored. You've got to hit a critical mass if you're in Congress. Now, of course, the critical mass is easy to define. It is the differential between the two major parties and what makes a controlling vote. If we've got a difference in the House between Democrats, if the Republicans have 20 more people than the Democrats, well, then that 20 votes, 21 is the margin of difference there. It'll take 21 Libertarians to control it. Once you could control it, then you could certainly make those points. You could get legislation happen. You can get people in the cabinet or getting committee chairs. You can look at Israel as an example of what happens in parties with in systems with third parties. It's often the marginal party that has the most the inordinate amount of power because it does control the debate.
But I'm just saying that since the Libertarian presidential candidate is not going to win in a landslide and bring a bunch of other Libertarians on his coattails, wouldn't it be more effective to spend all that money being spent on the campaigns at the presidential level, to spend all that money on House races so you could get that 21% that it would, or that 21 seats or whatever it was you just said, that would make the controlling difference in the House?
It would be great if we could. I mean, you know, it's the price per vote is probably higher when you hit the congressional level than it is the presidential. You certainly, if you've got a candidate that's viable and is paid attention to by the media, which is required in almost any race, if the media's not paying you any attention in a congressional race, you still got to buy all your media. That's a lot more expensive than getting it for free. Democrats and Republicans get most of their media, I shouldn't say most, they get a lot of their media for free. They certainly buy ads as well. But if we look at how many voters are in congressional districts, you're still talking about in the range of about, 450,000 to 500,000 people. If you just use really conservative estimates, the minimum amount it costs anymore to win a contested congressional race is in the range of about 2 million and up. The number of races in this country where the incumbent is susceptible is probably less than 5%. It has to be the right candidate in the right district in the right race in order for it to be winnable. If we could pick the scenario, it would be great. If we had a case with a Democrat and a Republican both tainted by scandal, would be the most likely thing for us to make a large progress at this point.
Well,
I personally think
the Libertarian presidential nominee should do real well this year running against the two scumbags he has in the major parties.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the interesting things, too, is I'm going to stand behind my prediction that Kerry will lose. And I've made that quite a long time ago because I've analyzed presidential races. Almost the least likely candidate to get elected is going to be somebody who served in Congress immediately prior. Most commonly, it's vice presidents that are elected president. The second after that is governors. And even after that is military people. And there's a real simple reason. There aren't voting records for any of those. The thing that's going to hurt Kerry the most is his voting record. You can say, I stand for this and I stand for that, and Bush can pull up, well, look, like he's doing. He voted against body armor for the troops. He voted against them protecting themselves and health care benefits and all that. And a governor doesn't have to worry about that, does he?
Well, especially not a governor from a state like Texas, where the governor doesn't have any real power anyway.
Exactly. So, I mean, it makes it a little bit easier. You can hide behind... There's less visibility, so I don't think Kerry's going to win no matter what. But I think the right place for us to win really is in state houses. Because making change is going to be easier at a state level. It would be nice to get more people elected to city councils. And actually, we're doing fairly well in certain areas. Like in Michigan, there's quite a few elected libertarians, mostly because of one small group of people who know how to get people elected to various city councils. They're having an effect. I mean, they're doing good stuff. They're keeping costs low. They're, you know, outsourcing. They're reducing sweetheart deals and improving the ethics. And that's what we really need, is not people who want to serve, but people who are serving and are doing it right, that they're living up to the commitments of libertarian principles, which basically, all let's face it, the most basic principle of libertarianism is ethics. It's about, you know, the responsibility of individuals to act ethically and responsibly in what they do. Carrying that to the state house is the next thing. There's certain states that are obviously easier than others. The state where we should be winning, I'm surprised we haven't done better in, is New Hampshire. They have something like 400 state legislators. There's only like 1,500 people in a district. That's something that is extremely achievable with a good candidate.
You support the idea of the Free State Project?
I think, like all experiments, they're worthy until they work or they don't. You know, I myself am not willing to give up the heat of Texas for the snow and mud of New Hampshire, no matter what. I think, you know, falling, you know, nice pretty leaves in the fall are great, and I'll go visit them once in a while, but I have no interest in living up there. I'm not a fan of New England. I was born in Old England, and I left it, and I like it here in Texas.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about, Texas. All right, so hey, I like this play in Karl Rove. Let's do this a little more. It seems to me that, in the end, in terms of the presidential election, next November, the pro-war libertarians / Republicans, they're going to vote for Bush because they say, well, he's better than Kerry. Anything's better than Kerry. Now, the anti-war right are going to vote libertarian or not at all. And
yep.
Meanwhile, all the anti-war leftists are going to vote for Kerry, who is pro-war, or Nader, which will help Bush get reelected and ratify his preemption strategy. So, if the IP's problem is numbers, then wouldn't it be much more effective to kick the pro-war Republicans out of the Libertarian Party and let the Libertarian Party be the champion of the anti-war movement, since more than half of the American people disapprove of what's going on in Iraq right now. Isn't this the Libertarian Party's big chance?
Well, it could very well be. I mean, I think that coupled with... I think Aaron Russo, actually, you know, I started... He talked to me, it must have been about 7 months ago, and was talking about the next big issue. He said, the big, you watch it, is going to be the draft. And, you know, I thought, like, what are you talking about? And I realize now that, you know, we're going to have a draft again in 2005. You know, Bush is saying, no, we don't want one, or Rumsfeld's saying, no, we don't want one. Of course they don't want one, but it's going to be necessary if they're going to keep this war machine going, because people aren't going into the reserves. Reserves doesn't mean you're being held in reserve right now. You know, that's not what it means. What it means is we're going to call you up after you've gotten a house and a family and a couple of kids, and then we're going to bring you back in, and we're not going to pay you enough, and your family's going to starve. And by the way, you're going to be in a foreign country fighting people who don't want you there, and your chances of dying are a little bit higher than you'd like. So they're not getting people signing up for the reserves or the guard, and that's going to start hitting very soon. It might take, you know, it might take a year before it really become apparent, but I do believe that there's going to be a move to bring the draft back. And the funny thing is the Democrats are the ones who seem to be leading the way with this.
Oh, of course, equality through equal enslavement of everyone.
Yep. And so that's, I think that's going to be a hot issue.
I think this is really my point. This is really my point. When leftist ideology is all based on service to the state and equality through equal slavery and all this, isn't the Libertarian Party in the prime position to be carrying the banner of the anti-war movement?
Well, I think they are. As long as it, you know, the only thing I'd say is that, you know, I think there's a significant difference between a pacifist and a libertarian when it comes to war. I'm not anti-war. I'm anti-this war. I mean, if Canada invades, I'm pro-war. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, sure. If anybody,
if Mexico comes over the border,
September 11th, nobody's attacked us since 1814. So that's all bullshit. You and I both know that we're living in an age of empire where the Constitution is taking its dying breath, and America is going around acting like England, and the world hates us for it. And so this is not a matter of, you know, if we were invaded or not. Nobody's invading. There is no invasion.
Oh, sure.
It's a matter of America acting like an empire, and shouldn't we be leading the charge against it, as opposed to kind of, I mean, let's be honest, the Libertarian Party, in most people's mind, is Republicans who smoke pot. And many, apparently, some percentage of the Libertarian Party are people who supported the war in Iraq. And I'm just saying, wouldn't it be better to kick them out and say, no, this is the anti-war, anti-empire party, and if you want to live in a limited republic, vote for us. That's the way to bring all that anti-war sentiment into the Libertarian Party.
Well, I mean, I agree that you know, I'd certainly welcome them to join us. I obviously, as chair, can't take a position where I say we should kick members out, okay, because that's policy that's by the delegation of the body. You know, you got to respect that a certain portion of my position is being a spokesperson for the platform and the rules as they are. And, of course, that's one of the things that, you know, we've had a lot of press releases. Our position has been staunchly anti-war all along. The problem has come up for me with people who want you to be pacifist, and I'm not a pacifist. I just don't believe in fighting people who aren't my enemies, and I'm not a big fan on theft. I'm not a big fan of invasion. You know this.
Sure. Well, I think the vast majority of anti-war libertarians would support a war if we were being invaded by another country.
You know, or even attacked.
The completely pacifist segment is a very small percentage, I think.
Absolutely, but I think
I
the pro.
Bad. I see all these left wingers acting like they're the anti-war movement when this is all their idea, world revolution to make the world safe for democracy and all that crap.
Yep.
This all comes from the left, and yet we're letting them have it. You know what I'm saying? We're letting them take away our thunder.
Well, I'm one of those people that thinks that the fact that Saddam Hussein got his ass kicked is absolutely fantastic. I just oppose the fact that it's our government that did it. And I think that, you know, I would have been perfectly happy to have the Iraqi people themselves have done it. Or if Iran had invaded Iraq, I would have said, well, there goes Saddam. That's what you get. My opposition is that we have no role there. We have no position and no justification to going and in attacking anybody else, in my opinion. One of the things that bothers me the most is when a president or a politician says that our job is to protect American interests. Well, I mean, you can sway that any way you want, of course. But that's like saying a guy who's stalking his girlfriend, it's in his interest to do so because he wants her.
Yeah, that's a nice analogy. You know, I mean, George, you know, Senior reduced it to our values. We must intervene overseas when our values are threatened. You know all those libertarian Jeffersonian values they have in Kuwait?
Yep. Oh, I know. I'm afraid that my foreign policy would be quite different. My first stance, I wouldn't even pull out of the UN because I don't believe world government. I pull out of the UN because I don't believe that body should allow any dictator to sit on it and make decisions in a democratic fashion. I find that just absolutely inconsistent. That, you know, Libya has a vote. Well, nobody's got a vote in Libya. You know, again, when Libya's, the head of the Human Rights Commission for the UN, I just think it has absolutely no credibility.
Nobody has a vote in America either. I mean, you get to run your little party and everything, but...
Yeah, but the difference there is that at least there's some lip service played to a voter choice. Now, of course... You know, we both know what Lenin said. You know, those that vote in a democracy, those that vote decide nothing. Those who count the votes decide everything. And, of course, democracy's flaw is the fact that somebody's got to tabulate that. We're seeing now that with the electronic votes, aren't we? We can't verify that those votes are really accurately cast.
Yep.
They've now created a total... it's a fiction. I mean, we have no... Nobody has any clue whether or not the votes cast are being tabulated correctly when they're using electronic voting. You as a voter, if you do vote, have no opportunity to verify that your vote was tabulated correctly.
And by the way, I'm with you on the United Nations. I was just thinking, you know, that comparison between us and Libya was too good to pass up. Especially now that we're best friends with them again.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, you know... Sometimes you have to, you know, it's really kind of a funny thing. We get this attitude in the U.S. that, for example, communism is bad. Well, okay, I don't like communism. But, here's a big but. If we look at certain places in Latin America, where the choice is a right-wing dictatorship supported by the church, protecting land grants given by the King of Spain in the 17th century, and the people have, you know, literally no opportunity because land ownership is not possible. The whole country was given to one guy. If you look at going from that to communism, I personally think communism is a step in the right direction. At least everybody in theory is equal, rather than perpetuating a system where you, in effect, in a lot of the Latin American countries, have nothing more than a transplantation of European noblesse oblige. You're not in the right class or the right family. You have nothing. You don't have rights. You can't have property. You're just European. They are very feudal. For those people, communism might be a step up. Is it desirable? Not for me. I'd rather have a free market. But I find it interesting that if you look around the world, that some of the countries that are the freest are the ones that went through communism because they were under the Russian influence, and some of the ones that are the most screwed up are the ones that came under our influence. It doesn't really matter to me if you're a peon under whatever system you're under. So certainly, I'm not. It reminds me of a friend I worked with for a long time as a blue-haired punk girl from London, and we both had the same vision of where we wanted the world to end up. I'm a libertarian, she was a communist, and she believed that you had to destroy before you could build a near anarchist world, if you want to call it that way, a minimal government world. I don't know if she's right. I don't know if she's wrong. She's just chosen a different path, but our objectives were the same. Do you know what I mean?
I sure do. It's a lot of what goes on up here at Radio Chaos. All right, well, everybody, Jeff Neal, he's the chairman of the Libertarian Party. Outgoing, right? You're going to pick a new chairman come May.
That's right. I got, I can count the days, I think. Now, what's the date today? Yeah, I've got three more weeks, tomorrow, and they'll be picking a guy to carry on in my stead.
Well, let's hope you make the best of them. I read your little column in that Libertarian newsletter, the message from the chair. Thought that was a pretty good way to head out the door.
Well, I mean, a lot of times, I think the problem with it, probably people out there in the audience going, well, that guy talks too much, but one of the reasons sound bites work is really simple. Because anything you cannot communicate in a short period of time is unlikely to get communicated well. Sometimes the simpler truths are the easiest ones to transmit. And I've tried very hard with people in the Libertarian Party to get them to learn how to say things non-academically. It's just the intent there is to get people to listen to what you've got to say. I've had people approach me and say, well, I need you to read this book, and then you'll understand what I'm talking about. Well, that's a hell of a sales pitch. I mean, that's like dating a girl and saying, let me sit down and let me show you my medical history and show you all my family albums and tell you about my financial situation, and then we can go on a date. You don't work that way. You got to get something to get people in the door. Libertarians have all the right ideas. They have all the good ideas. What we haven't learned how to do is how to market it properly. And it's really, I think, a matter of just keeping it very simple. Like I like to tell people is that we believe that you're probably smarter than most of the people in Washington telling you what to do.
Makes perfect sense, doesn't it?
It does to me. And who better to run your school district than you? You think somebody in Washington really cares? It's a lot of it is just understanding basic, again, I'm going to sound like an academic, basic social dynamics. You always care more about your neighbor than you do a nameless, faceless person in Iowa. You don't know that person. You go, oh, that's a shame that person got killed, you know, in that tornado that ripped up the town and 20 people were killed. But your neighbor breaks his leg, and you care, because you know him, and you like him. And that's why we want politics to be local. It's people will care about their government. And you know, and the mechanisms of the social environment they live in, when they're connected to them.
When they believe that they can actually have influence.
Yeah, well, they can either make a change, or they can make what, you know, they can make waves, or they can just you know, get on out of there and go somewhere else. People forget in this country that the idea that the founding fathers was to create 13 laboratories of democracy. It was not to create a unified structure and top-down management. The federal government has gone great lengths to, in the name of making sure that we have standards for everybody, they're trying to ensure the lowest common denominator, of course. Any certification, any kind of process like that tends to move towards a lower set of qualities. As a friend of mine was a midwife, and she had all the credentials she needed to go and get a state certification in California to be a midwife, and she says, no, I refuse. I said, well, just, you know, I can understand that, but why? She says, well, that certification, all it says is that I'm good enough to pass their test. It doesn't say I'm the best there is. It says, you know, and as long as I get that, people are going to put me in the same group with everybody else. And I kind of like that attitude. You know, the goal of any person who's out there is self-respecting is to be not an average person, is it? There's a lot of... Society is always dragged along by the exceptional and by the radicals and by the people willing to get out there and do things differently, the willing to take a risk, willing to take a chance. Society as a whole always benefits from that. Federalism at the level the federal government is pursuing is doing everything it can to kill that. And I... 100% against that. I like the idea that if Oregon wants to try legalized marijuana, that the rest of us could say, let's see what happens.
Yeah, and all we see in that case is heroin and cocaine use and alcohol drinking go through the floor as everybody just starts smoking weed.
Well, yeah, you'd see a lot of things, I think, happening there. I mean, you know, I lived in Amsterdam for 6 months. My best friend is Dutch. I'm very familiar with the system there. England has been decriminalizing its marijuana over the last year and a half, and one of the reasons they did is they noticed that the incidence of the rate of marijuana usage in England was more than double what it was in Holland, but in Holland it's legal. You know, there's no penalties for
drugs.
Well, I mean, they won the war on drugs by turning it into a skirmish, okay? This is something people don't understand. They took that tornado and turned it into a wind. It's the end result is we don't want people destroying their lives with drugs. And I'm perfectly in favor of that. I don't want people destroying their lives with French fries. I don't want people being so obese they're getting diabetes and dying. I'm not in favor of, you know, I'm opposed to. I want abortion to be an unnecessary medical procedure because all pregnancies are voluntary and wanted. I don't see how making any of these things illegal, making them prohibited, solves the real problem. You're just trying to hit the symptoms. You're trying to punish people for behaving differently than what you want people to behave. Not going to change people wanting people to not be drug addicts or drunks or addicted gamblers or whatever. But, you know, there's other ways to get there. And I like to just look at, well, again, in our society, we've been raised with this mantra for the last, I don't know, has it been 100 years maybe? The greatest good for the greatest number. Well, that's a socialist philosophy. The libertarian viewpoint on that, in my opinion, is the greatest good with the least harm. If you believe the greatest good for the greatest number, then you can justify what happened in Germany to the Jews. Because I'm sure they would have told you at the time, this benefits the vast majority of Germans by us killing these Jewish children. It's an evil mantra, and I wish people would realize that the only thing you can say is, first do no harm.
Yeah, or we hold these truths to be self-evident.
Yep.
That's a fact of mine.
And of course, but even if you use that, if you say, you know, first do no harm, you come down to the point where you realize that you've got to grant everybody freedom. It's not going to work. It's not going to work if somebody else gets to decide whether or not you get to exercise freedoms. Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm one of the few people who have, the Supreme Court has decided do not get the same free speech rights that other people do. Which is a real interesting scenario to be in. I never thought I'd be, you know, a special class, but Congress passed the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act of 2002, and in the name of making sure that there wasn't dirty money in politics, they made it a felony for employees or officers of national political parties to solicit funds on behalf of state parties or non-federal parties or non-federal candidates. So if I stand up in front of a group of libertarians and say, support your local candidates, give them your money so that they can win, I've committed a felony.
And you're not saying that, right? You're just saying what would happen if you did say that.
Oh, of course, no, I'm not saying that. I wouldn't possibly break the law. In fact, I don't do that. I tell people, look, I can't say this to you.
Well, it's perfectly fine, though, to give, or for a Republican or a Democrat to take all the money they want from Saudi Arabia or Israel or China, though. but the chairman of the LP can't encourage people in the LP to support their local candidates.
Oh, well, get this. And, of course, the other thing is that it doesn't apply to elected officials. So whereas I, as chair of the Libertarian Party, cannot go to the text, I was in California at their convention, and they said, well, gee, you want to do the fundraising? I said, well, could be tough. I'm not sure I want to go to jail right now. So I couldn't help them with the fundraising, even though not a penny of that money would have gone into my pocket or the national pocket or into a federal race. It was, would have all purely been for the California Party. I couldn't do it. But now, if George Bush flies to California and goes to the Republican convention, he can. It's only officers of the National Party that cannot. So, I mean, it's... I'm sure there's a lot of people who are going to hear that and say, boy, I'm glad it doesn't apply to me. But the scariest thing of all is that the Supreme Court ruled, in a very close decision, it was 5-4, they ruled that this was constitutional because it wasn't in violation of the First Amendment. The First Amendment says, of course, Congress shall pass no law, and so forth and so on, regarding freedom of speech. They ruled that this wasn't, this was constitutional because it was only restricting the freedom of speech. So, yeah, I get a little bit scared with the way our Supreme Court occasionally rules on stuff.
It's funny, too, because when George Bush signed that campaign reform law, he said, well, I know that most of it's unconstitutional, but I'm going to go ahead and sign it and just go ahead and let the Supreme Court strike it down later. And then they didn't. They upheld it all.
The funny thing is that the only thing I thought was constitutional was the one thing they upheld. So obviously shows that I obviously see the law a little bit differently. And that was the restricting, not allowing donations by anybody who's under 18. And I thought that could be constitutionally justified because the Constitution also has a restriction on the voting age. My opinion is that it would be constitutional, not saying I'm in favor of it, but it would have been constitutional to state that only people eligible to vote can donate to political parties. And that would have been something that would have been constitutional and would have cut all the corporate money out of the deal. Problem is what Congress did was they said any money given from a corporation to a political party or candidate for any reason whatsoever is a donation. So let me give you the simplest example of how stupid this is. We have a national office in the Watergate building in D.C. We like being in a great neighborhood. We're right next door to Monica Lewinsky's lawyer. If somebody breaks into our office and steals a couple of computers, we, of course, are insured. We go to the insurance company and we say, oh, we had a claim. We need to get you to pay us for the computers that were stolen. They write a check to us. We cannot take it. It's illegal. That's the way Congress wrote the law. Now, of course, the FEC is having to backpedal on some of this and say, wait a minute, that's stupid. You can't do that. If you own a building and you own a 10-story building, but you're only using 8 of the floors, you decide to rent 2 of them out. You couldn't rent them out. Somebody could donate you a truck. Here's my father died, and here's a $20,000 Ford F-150. I'm giving it to the Libertarian Party. You go, this is really cool. We got a $20,000 donation. We claim that as a donation. We then try to sell it in order to recoup the value. Business couldn't buy it. It would have to come from an individual. Now, the individual buys it, sends us a $20,000 check, and we have to claim that as a deduction as a donation as well. So even though we want to receive $20,000 worth of value, because of the way the law is written, we have to claim $40,000 in donations.
Man,
so you see what I'm getting at. The problem with Congress is really simple. I'll put it as simply as I can. Congress is full of absolute morons that don't understand the real world.
Well, and they have absolute power. As long as there's no limits on their jurisdiction, then they're going to do goofy shit.
The morning talk show, Bob and Tom, I can't remember which one it is. I like his idea. He said every year we should have a simple system. You take 10 congressmen and 2 senators, put them in a room and say, do your own taxes. If they don't get them right, you execute them.
Yeah.
And you keep doing that until they get the taxes to where they can do them themselves.
That's
but it is amazing these guys don't know what they sign.
You know,
they don't
friend,
think of the ramifications.
I have a friend who's been living in England for the past year, and he sent me an email the other day talking about it's so much more generally free in England. And I'm thinking, man, they don't even have a First Amendment there. They don't even pretend to have the kind of history of revolution and limited government that we have here in America, and yet my Texan American friend in England is having a hell of a lot better time there.
Well, I've lived a lot of my life overseas. I mean, I was born in England. I lived there until I was 8. I spent, 6 months in Amsterdam, about 8 years living in Germany. It is very different. I've said to people, they said, well, this is the best place in the world to live. And I said, it depends on who you are and what it is you value. Because certainly if you want to start, let's say you live here in Texas, you want to start a bar. Well, you got to go get a liquor license, don't you? And that costs a lot of money. And they decide whether or not you're going to get one. But if you're in Germany, you want to start a bar, you start a bar. Okay, you got to file with the government and tell them to get a tax ID and all that so they can collect their taxes. But it's not like you have to ask their permission. And that's the big difference. If you want to do something like that, it is a lot easier. You can look in much of countries like Germany and France and see that the corporations are not as powerful as they are here in the U.S. And a lot of it is because of things like if you have a state that grants licenses to sell liquor regardless of how many locations you have, so it's one price per, you can do the math real quick. You got 100 places, it's a heck of a lot cheaper than the guy who's opening one just for himself. Now, the only way to equalize that, of course, is make it the same for everyone or make it per unit or just make it you don't need a license.
Yeah,
or the license is...
Three there. I hate to cut you off here, Mr. Neal, but we're out of time. Do you have any
No, not a problem.
Comments?
It's been good talking with you.
Do you have any closing comments, last-minute sound bites you'd like to get out before I cut you off here?
Yeah, it's time to kick Democrats or Republicans out of office and get some people in that really care about America. How's that?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about. Everybody, Jeff Neal, he's the national chairman of the Libertarian Party.